I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up on this President's Day, is President Bush restricting access to his and other presidential papers? But first, Democratic leaders are seeking to limit or even overturn the 2002 resolution that gave the president authorization to go to war in Iraq. Here's Senator Hillary Clinton speaking on her website.
We need to begin a phased redeployment of our troops out of Iraq. I've been pushing for this for almost 2 years. Now it's time to say the redeployment should start in 90 days or the Congress will revoke authorization for this war.
Well, we're joined first by Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe. And Rick, some might say, what's the thinking here? Senate Democrats couldn't even get debate going on a non-binding resolution. How are they going to now pull back troops?
Well, I think a lot of this is driven by a lot of liberal Democrats in the party who are frustrated that more isn't being done substantively and more quickly to bring an end to the war. They tried the non-binding route. They got some success in the House on Friday. But on Saturday, of course, the Senate was unable to proceed. They didn't get the 60 votes they needed to cut off debate. So now the thinking is, well, if we can't do something non-binding, let's at least try to do something binding on the president. Even if it isn't as successful at first, they can hope to build some momentum and maybe a vote down the road that has better results.
Well, and the House did, as you say, pass their non-binding resolution, but with far fewer Republican defections than they originally thought. And that raises the question, did they also lose some political steam at the end of last week? Representative Murtha of Pennsylvania of the House Appropriations Committee has vowed that the next step is to put conditions on the funding that the president is requesting for the war. But do they still have that political momentum?
Well, a lot of this is posturing at this point. It's not clear where the votes are. I think it is clear that there are not enough votes to do something very drastic like cutting off funding for the war altogether. But in terms of attaching conditions, it could be something that Democrats are able to muscle through. The restrictions are mostly geared toward troop readiness, which is something that could be something that a lot of Democrats, maybe even some Republicans, can swallow. But as they're seeing already, it's just extremely difficult for Congress to build a consensus and a coalition that really directs the course of the war. And that's really the challenge for them moving forward.
Why didn't the House lawmakers get as many Republican defections as they thought they might? And we're wondering if it had anything to do with the news that came from the White House last week, news about North Korea, Iran, that maybe worked against the Democrats?
I think the biggest thing that worked against the Democrats were the Democrats themselves. I think when Congressman Murtha came out the day before the vote and said, hey, this vote's basically the preseason, the real fight is going to be when we push to cut off funding or restrict funding. That, I think, bled away a lot of Republicans who may have been inclined to support the non-binding resolution. Republicans after the vote were saying that Jack Murtha was their best lobbyist against the resolution. But I do think in the broader context, the White House was working against this. They wanted to minimize the number of Republican defections. They were fairly successful in that. But I know a lot of Republicans on the Hill were saying to the White House, this is really the last vote that we can promise you. Things better shape up or you better change course really quickly.
Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, Congress is on a week-long break, but President's Day is a busy one for presidential hopefuls. So far, at least a dozen have visited South Carolina, which has the earliest primary of any southern state. Republican John McCain and Democrats Barack Obama, Christopher Dodd, and Hillary Clinton all visited South Carolina over the long weekend. Carol Kerr Fowler is the second vice chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. So early this election cycle, have you ever seen anything like this, all this activity?
No, I really have not. And South Carolina has had an early primary before and has received a lot of attention, but truly this activity is just more than we've ever seen.
Well, you just came from an event with Senator Hillary Clinton, a town hall meeting in Columbia. First of all, how was she received?
Oh, she was very warmly received. She had a huge crowd and a very diverse crowd, and there was just so much energy in the room. Everybody was clapping and cheering and standing up. Truly a very strong reception.
You know, I wonder if she was asked about something she said over the weekend. As you well know, she's been dogged by her 2002 vote to authorize the war. She refused to apologize, saying it's not her mistake. It was the president's mistake in intelligence. This weekend in Dover, New Hampshire, she said, if you want a candidate who will apologize for that vote, you should support someone else. So how big an issue is that for voters there?
The war is a very big issue for Democratic voters here. They are very opposed to the war. I have not seen any evidence that they're angry with her over her positions with the war. But you know, that may come. Right now, we're still in the first...
the honeymoon stage.
Honeymoon with all these candidates.
Well, about half the voters in the Democratic primary there in South Carolina are African American, and the local newspaper, The State, writes that, you know, race is going to be important in the election. And it did come up last week, as you well know. African-American Democratic State Senator Robert Ford said the Democrats would lose not only the White House, but the House, the Senate, even governor's races, if Barack Obama leads the Democratic ticket. Now, Senator Ford has since apologized for those remarks, but did he speak an unspoken thought that many there may have?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. Maybe Senator Ford has that thought, but I have heard no one else voice that position at all.
Well, we know Barack Obama was there. On Friday, he spoke at the convention center, attracting 3,000 people. Now, I wanted to ask you, is this are South Carolinians hearing perhaps a new Southern Senator Obama? Let's listen.
Southern Illinois is the South. And when we won the primary, we won not just the black vote, we won the white vote. We didn't just win the Northern vote, we won the Southern vote. Let me admit, I was a little surprised myself.
Carol Fowler, how was he received? And didn't he sound a little more Southern than he normally does?
Maybe he did. He was very well received. I was so impressed with the youth of the audience that turned out for Senator Obama. He had two huge crowds in South Carolina, and they were very young crowds. The average age was a lot younger than what we normally see at political events.
Carol Carrot Fowler, second vice chair for the Democratic Party in South Carolina, with sort of an update on the goings-on there. Carol, thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
And for a broader look at the presidential campaign trail, we turn to Bob Benenson, editor of Congressional Quarterly and CQPolitics.com. And first of all, Bob, we just heard Carol Fowler there in South Carolina say that she didn't think that State Senator Robert Ford's comments that an Obama ticket would hurt Democrats, you know, nationwide reflects what voters are thinking there. But are Democratic operatives worried about that or talking about that?
Well, you know, obviously with somebody making the most serious bid to become the first African-American president, the question of whether America is ready for a black president is going to be an underlying issue. Very few people are saying it. Certainly very few are saying it as out loud as Senator Ford, who I just read the AP story about the flap where he apologized, and it was one of the most curious apologies I've ever seen. He said, if I cause anybody, including myself, any pain about the comments I made earlier, that I want to apologize to myself and to Senator Obama. Now, very few people making one of these non-apology apologies actually apologize to themselves for the pain they've caused to themselves. So,
why do you think that Barack Obama, who is so popular, you know, as testified by his appearances, as we just heard, is trailing Hillary Clinton and John Edwards in the polls in South Carolina? Remind us of why that might be when half of the Democratic voters are African-American?
Well, you know, there are two major things that we have to take into consideration here. First of all, Hillary Clinton and John Edwards both have been making serious approaches to black voters. Hillary Clinton's husband, President Bill Clinton, was extremely popular amongst African-American voters in this country. So, I mean, she starts out with that legacy and with her own efforts to connect with that very large part of the Democratic base. John Edwards is a native of South Carolina, represented North Carolina in the Senate for 6 years, and the main core theme of his campaign, in fact, his whole political outlook, is eradicating poverty.
In fact, some of the African Americans in South Carolina say they're insulted that people would assume that they would vote for someone just because they're African American.
Exactly right. Yeah. I mean, putting aside Senator Ford's stock statement there.
I want to take a quick look at the Republican side while we have you there. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney was on This Week with George Stephanopoulos yesterday, and he was asked about what some are perceiving as his flip-flopping on gun control. Let's listen to that exchange.
You were supportive of the Brady Bill, the handgun waiting period in the past. You signed an assault weapon ban into law, and you said in the past, I don't line up with the NRA. Now,
on that issue.
Now you're a member of the NRA.
Yes, and I know the NRA does not support an assault weapon ban, so I don't line up on that particular issue with the NRA, either does President Bush.
Well, and Mitt Romney has said, or it's reported that he just joined the NRA this past August. His critics have said in the past that he changed his opinion, flip-flopped, if you will, on gay marriage and abortion, and now they say he's doing the same on gun control. How is this affecting his campaign, his very young campaign?
Well, you know, the problem that Mr. Romney is going to face on this is that, you know, lots of people are willing to cut people, you know, politicians slack for personal growth or change of opinion or whatever. Romney, when he first ran for the United States Senate in 1994, and also to some extent in his successful candidacy for governor of Massachusetts, a very liberal state, obviously, in 2002, was much more of a moderate on these social issues. Now he says he's changed his opinion. He was wrong about a lot of things. He's now, you know, right in line with social conservatives. Even if the social conservative constituency, which is, you know, a major part of the Republican base, is willing to accept that on face value, there are a lot of candidates in the field right now who always held those positions, who are really true believers on the social conservative agenda. So for the voters who really expect the Republican Party and the Republican nominee for president to subscribe to those issues, they're going to look to these other candidates first, unless suddenly the party is taking a much more pragmatic approach. I mean, what we're seeing in polls right now is Rudy Giuliani, the former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, leading by some great extent in the polls.
Well, someone else.
A lot of that is name ID, but right. The fact of the matter is he's a social liberal.
Well, another Republican who's in the polls, but he has not declared, is Newt Gingrich. He was on Fox News this Sunday. He says he won't even think about running until Labor Day, and that the campaigning has begun too early, that voters are going to be sick and tired of the election before it even gets started. Let's listen to him.
This is going to be like watching bad reruns of Survivor. People are going to say, get him off the island. I don't want to see this anymore. You watch. Mark my word. I'll come back this summer at some point if you'll have me. And we'll talk about how bored people are with this campaign.
Bob Benenson, do you think he's coming back as a candidate?
Gingrich is in a beautiful position because he's not an office holder. He's basically an outside commentator on politics right now. He can sit back. He's one of the few people who can sit back because he's got a certain amount of name identification and see if the whole field comes to ground. If all the candidates who are running right now are found wanting or nobody emerges as a front runner, he has more potential than most. You can say the same thing about Al Gore on the Democratic side because of his name identification to step into a free-for-all race and establish himself late as a candidate. Logistically, it's very difficult. The necessities of fundraising, setting up a political organization across the country may make it even impossible for even somebody like Newt Gingrich to jump into the race in, say, September. But he's got nothing to lose. I mean, he can sit back and do whatever he's doing right now and gaining attention as a conservative commentator on American politics if he decides not to run for president. And yet, he's still drawing this attention as somebody who might run at this stage in the campaign.
And it doesn't cost him a penny. Bob Benenson, editor of Congressional Quarterly and CQPolitics.com. Thanks for helping us survey the landscape this President's Day.
My pleasure.
Okay, when we come back, the flap over President Bush's executive order restricting access to presidential papers. We'll find out more about that. And later in the program, the church diet. Is it a cult? More coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as usual, presidential libraries and museums are marking this day with special exhibits and events. But scholars are also hoping that President Bush will reverse a decision he made in 2001 that would limit the public release of presidential papers. We're going to take up that topic in a moment. But first, this morning, President Bush spoke at Mount Vernon, home of the nation's first president, George Washington.
Honoring George Washington's life requires us to remember the many challenges that he overcame. And the fact that American history would have turned out very differently without his steady leadership.
In Dallas today, the sixth-floor museum at Dealey Plaza is displaying for the first time a newly discovered home movie of President Kennedy's motorcade just 90 seconds before he was assassinated there in 1963. It's a brief silent film, which you can see by going to our website, here-now.org. It does not show the shooting, but you can clearly see JFK and Jacqueline Kennedy smiling and waving as the motorcade passes by. Well, Julian Zelitzer is a history professor at Boston University. He joins us now for a look at many things presidential. Julian, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
Nice to see you. And first of all, this film, have you seen it?
Yeah, I did see it.
It's something, isn't it? So clear.
It's clear and nothing dramatic happens. It's before the shooting and I think it makes it more haunting. You know what's about to come and you see the moment before we knew the shooting happened.
It's much clearer than the Zapruder film.
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't know, it just tells you what about the happiness. It was a moment before everything changed.
Well, yeah, no, it captures the moment before the assassination. And it's hard to do that given we all remember the assassination or have read or seen part of it. I think it's a little film, but it's very powerful.
Well, we recommend people go see it again, here-now.org to see it. Well, that's one piece of information from these libraries. The official Kennedy Library and Museum, of course, here is in Boston. Other former presidents have their official libraries in their home states. Harry Truman's in Missouri. Jimmy Carter's in Georgia. You've been a lot of them to do research. Why are they so important?
These are the records of our presidents. I mean, when we write our history books and when the public starts to think about what happened in a given period, this is where you look. These presidential libraries have all the papers about what happened in the administration and what the president was thinking at a given moment in time. So we can't really understand Vietnam or the 80s without having these libraries open.
Is there a difference between what you get to see as a researcher and what the public sees?
Yeah, there's two parts of a museum. One part is a display of the White House, and they usually have all kinds of memorabilia. And then there's a little back room where all the historians are usually sitting. Not very dramatic. It's pretty ugly room usually, but that's where all the documents are.
And that's potentially things that public doesn't see? I mean,
they can see. I mean, it's open, but that's not usually, if you're going just to visit, you won't see this. And if you go to the Johnson Library, a lot of scholars are looking at White House memoranda or the tapes people have heard.
Right.
That's where you'd sit down and kind of wrestle with these things.
Well, this brings us to the question we want to ask you. You know, obviously, then these libraries have a wealth of information. Will they have less because of Executive Order Number 13233? This is President Bush's 2001 directive. First of all, what does it say?
It basically gives the sitting president the power to veto requests to open material before the material opened after 12 years. It wasn't always processed, but it was a natural and automatic process. But the president, citing national security reasons, gave himself and future presidents the ability to say no, including to previous presidents.
So, to make that clear. So it's from 2001 out, but a president such as President Bush could decide that papers from the Johnson administration shouldn't be released. Is that?
Absolutely. I think he did for the Reagan administration already, held back documents, and there has been debates with the Clinton Library. Clinton wants all his papers open, and I think there's been rumblings from the administration, if not clear decisions, that not all of it will be opened, and the president can do that.
So even a living president might not be able to put out papers because of this directive
exactly.
If a sitting president decides that he can't.
Exactly.
Well, beyond access for historians and researchers such as yourself, what do you see as the other issues here?
Look, there's two big issues. One, it's not just for the historians, it's what they produce. So the history books people like to hear about or read either secondhand or directly can't be produced if we have limited information. I think that is detrimental to our understanding of the past. And second, it's this bigger issue that we're all wrestling with now, secrecy in government. This is one other example of where we've seen an attempt to restrict more documents, to restrict public knowledge of what goes on in government. And the revolution of the 70s was to say this is public information, not government property.
Well, and some scholars are pleading with Southern Methodist University to do something about this. There's a controversy brewing there in Texas over the future presidential library for George W. Bush. Southern Methodist University wants it. The faculty there are divided. But some scholars are saying you should make a contingent on rescinding this directive. Any chance that's going to happen, you know?
I can't imagine the president would be moved by a bunch of scholars. So far, he hasn't. I don't know. Maybe if it affects his own personal legacy in this library, he would think about it, but I can't imagine.
Well, meanwhile, we mentioned the faculty divided, some protesting that they disagree with the war in Iraq and other Bush policies, so they don't want the library there. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I personally think that's a mistake. I mean, you don't want to base your decision to have a library on what you think of the president. I mean, that's not the purpose of these libraries, and the whole purpose is to study what happened, whether you agree or disagree with the president. But certainly there is an argument to be made. If you have a president hostile to the notion of presidential libraries, there's questions, should we then house it without any kind of response or criticism of what the president has done?
Is there a danger, though, of – and do presidential libraries – turn into sort of partisan think tanks?
No. The whole thing with the Bush Library is the condition is to attach a partisan think tank to it. And that's part of what some people are saying at SMU. Let's have the library, but not this think tank. Same thing happened with Reagan. Stanford ultimately rejected the Reagan Library, in part for similar concerns, and it moved to a separate location. But the libraries are not partisan think tanks at all. These are repositories of documents and a way for the public to come see a little bit about a president. It's often choreographed and favorable to the president, but you see some pretty neat stuff, to be honest, and I think people like it.
How are they funded?
Privately. Most of this is all private donations. That's another source of controversy with the Clinton Library. It was a big source of controversy. People were giving money for this, often who wanted favors from the president. And there's some concern that we shouldn't continue this system of private funding either.
Well, in fact, new House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is trying to figure out if that can happen, supporting legislation to change that. So we'll keep an eye on that. Julian Zelitz, our history professor at Boston University. Thanks, as always, for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And you can link to all the official presidential libraries by going to our website, here-now.org. And don't forget, while there, the brand new film that some fellow's son discovered in a drawer, a film that he took on that day when Kennedy was assassinated, just before the assassination. That's there at here-now.org as well. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Is being fat a sin? Americans spend $40 billion a year on diet plans, and a growing market is the faith-based diet. There's the popular book, What Would Jesus Eat? It promotes a lean Mediterranean diet that eliminates pork, which is prohibited by the Bible. Then there is the Way Down diet. It was created by Gwen Shamblin in 1986. By 1993, she claimed it was taught in 30,000 churches and homes. Her book sold a million copies, and she started her own church outside Nashville, the Remnant Fellowship Church, which some former followers are now concerned may have become a cult. Journalist Melba Newsom is one of them. Her article, Praying to Be Thin, appeared in Self magazine, and she joins us from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Melba, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Now, I understand you first became interested in writing about the diet because you'd tried it.
Basically, I came into the program initially because I thought it made sense. I really identified when she said we shouldn't be trying to make the food behave, that we in general are too fat because we, in essence, eat too much. And the first time I tried the program, I liked it and I lost 10 pounds.
The theory was that you should love God more than eating.
That's the theory, is that if you transfer that love for food into your love for God, then you will eat when you're hungry and stop when you're full. That's the basic theory of the diet.
Right, and literally hungry. I mean, your stomach growling.
Yes.
You went back after your first run at the diet. What was the rhetoric when you went back the second time?
The diet itself had not changed. What seemed problematic for me was the focus on one bite beyond full is crowning yourself above God and the consequences of that, eternal damnation. The message was, this is the only way to be saved.
Was it also this is the only way to lose weight? I mean, were they combined?
Precisely. It was diets don't work and you've got to give your food over to God.
And give yourself over to this church. Well, you visited the Remnant Fellowship Church outside Nashville. What was it like there?
It's kind of community where everybody there spends most of their time with each other, a little bit isolated. So I went to see what that was about and listen to the message. And everyone there is very thin.
And yet, what did you see them eat? I mean, you had an interesting assessment of what they actually ate.
The general consensus, you know, in the nutrition community is that there are no bad foods. They subscribe to that notion, but it seems in a way that they have turned the traditional good foods into bad foods because there is rarely any vegetables. It's a diet heavily laden with junk food. Hamburgers, French fries, potato chips, chocolate, ice cream. there was one night we went to a program, and afterwards there was a buffet, and it was entirely of desserts.
Well, and some people might say, well, this sounds like a good thing. You didn't see any overweight people, and they're eating dessert buffets. What did you start to see as a problem?
The focus on this is the only way to God, this is the only way to heaven, people severing ties with other family members who weren't involved with the church. Questions aren't welcome or tolerated. It's considered if you're asking a lot of questions because you don't agree with or don't understand, that's considered disrespectful.
Well, others are also monitoring the remnant church. You quote Rafael Martinez. He runs the watchdog group Spirit Watch Ministries. They track religious and social fringe groups. He says that while members of the remnant diet church don't have to give up all their money, they do sever relations with families, and they're told the remnant church is the only true church. Melba, you met people who left because they felt it was cultish, and that includes Lauren Nichols. Now, she had quit her Southern Baptist congregation in 2001 to start a Houston chapter of the Remnant Church. What did she tell you about being pushed there to lose weight?
She said Shamlin chastised her for not losing more weight and said she needed to stop, quote, being a billboard to sin. She also told her to step down from leadership of the church, basically told her to get her weight under control before she could continue leading, having a leadership role in the church.
How much was she eating at that point?
At that point, she was eating 9 bites of food a day, 3 bites per meal. And I found a ton of people who had left because they felt the church was too controlling and that it separated them from family members or whatever.
Or worse, there's a disturbing story about corporal punishment and 2 church members. Joseph and Sonia Smith pleaded guilty and will be tried this month after being arrested for allegedly beating their 8-year-old son to death.
Yes.
And during the investigation into that case, a remnant church member, leaked a tape in which Gwen Shamblin advised the Smiths on disciplining their son. What did she say?
They told of locking him in a room for the entire weekend with only his Bible. And Gwen could be heard saying, oh, that's really great, praise God. Shortly after that, the child died.
Of course, she's not being accused of having anything to do with his death.
Correct.
Well, you spoke to Gwen Shamblin about all of these accusations, that her group is a cult, that she makes people do certain things. What did she say in response?
She denies that. She's heard the criticism about Way Down being a cult, and she essentially calls it a bunch of malarkey and says that that idea is promoted by people who were formerly with the church, but became disenchanted and left. And she says, under their crude definition, every church is a cult.
Melba, as we said, there are other faith-based diets, and they're extremely popular. After having done this research, what is your take on them? Is Shamblin completely out on the fringe of this, or is this reflecting other churches?
She's completely different, in my opinion, because most of the faith-based diets that I have research basically talk about relying on God and gluttony is a sin, but they haven't started their own church. There's no pressure to leave whatever religious community you're with. There's no talk of this is the only way to be saved or anything like that. It's basically more spiritual program.
I'm thinking that, you know, the idea of turning your problems, whether they be diet or drinking or anything, over to God or a higher power, you know, is the basis of all 12-step. So it's not as if it's not as if this is unheard of to ask for God's help.
You're right in that most 12-step, that's the key, is turning it over to a higher power. This goes beyond that in saying that your salvation is tied to your weight, actually.
And in fact, to Gwen Shamblin.
Yes.
Melba Newsom reported on the faith-based diet called the Way Down Program in Self magazine. She's speaking to us from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. And Melba, it's fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Just want to take a second for a quick note about tomorrow's program. Author Mark Bowden of Black Hawk Down fame will tell us the story of the terrorist in the Philippines who dressed like an American hip-hop star and made daily calls to radio stations while he kidnapped and killed an American missionary. Could the story of the capture of one of Asia's most wanted terrorists be a model for cracking other insurgencies? Mark thinks so. That's tomorrow. And don't forget, before we go today, for a dose of history, culture, and conversation with your kid, try watching an old movie together. Really, they won't know it's good for them. You're listening to Here and Now. Your favorite podcast may be a technology guide or, let's say, French 101, or maybe it's Here and Now. By the way, you can download the whole show for podcasts at here-now.org. But enough about me. What about the Byzantine Empire? It turns out that one of the most popular podcasts, with over 100,000 listeners worldwide, is about the 1,200 or so years after the fall of Rome. Its creator, Lars Brownworth, is not a renowned historian of the Byzantine Empire. He is a high school American history teacher at the Stony Brook School on Long Island in New York, and he joins us now with more. Lars, welcome.
Glad to be here.
So what is your tie to the Byzantine Empire?
Purely one of interest.
And by the way, remind us what the Byzantine Empire is.
Sure. The Roman Empire split in half, the East and the West. And after the West fell, historians like to call the Eastern part the Byzantine Empire.
And this is all at around what?
In the 4th century.
So that's when it starts. When does it end?
In 1453, with the Turks conquering the city of Constantinople.
Okay. And we coined the term Byzantine later, didn't we? I mean, the people at the time thought of themselves as Roman.
That's right. If you had called them Byzantine, they wouldn't have known what you were talking about.
So what kind of things do you tell people about the Byzantine Empire? And we know you go ruler by ruler. What do you tell people?
It's basically the 12 rulers I find are most important in the history. It's really just a chronology of their reign.
Well, let's listen to a little. We have a clip. Why don't you set this up for us?
Sure. There was an emperor named Basil II. He had been fighting for 30 years to put down the Kingdom of Bulgaria, which was in revolt against him. And at the end of that 30 years, he finally caught up with the Bulgarian Tsar, whose name was Samuel. He completely crushes them in the battle, and now he has to decide what to do with the prisoners.
Let's listen.
Wanting to break the will of those still intending to resist, he ordered the eyes to be put out of all 14,000 captives. One out of every 100 was to have a single eye spared, by which they could lead their compatriots back to the Tsar. When the pathetic group shuffled into Samuel's presence, he collapsed in shock, dying 2 days later a broken man.
These people gouged out eyes, and what else was I reading? When one leader killed another, they used his skull as a mug. How much of this part of that time in history is what captivates you?
The blood and gore, it can get tedious, but I think a lot of the attraction is just the strangeness of it and the sense that this is somehow a lost history.
Yes, and to tell us more about that, because, you know, people think that, oh, you know, Rome fell and then there was a Renaissance. But actually there was all this, you know, 1,000 years in between.
Yeah, when I grew up, I thought of the Middle East as going from a classical past to a Islamic present with nothing really in between. You know, I thought the Roman Empire ended in 476. No, actually it continued on for another 1,000 years.
What can we learn about the Byzantine Empire that can help us understand that area today?
Since the empire lasted for so long, it was a major source of culture for the region. I think the Islamic world looks at the West still through the lens of the Crusades, but the West has completely forgotten about Byzantium and Byzantine history, and I think it does us a disservice. We have no context to understand how they're viewing us and even how to view them.
Can you tell us your favorite story from the podcast?
Sure. There's sort of this Braveheart moment where Justinian, who turns into probably the greatest Byzantine emperor, is facing these riots which are going to topple him from his throne. And he and all his advisors and his wife Theodora are meeting to decide what to do. They get there and everyone is telling Justinian to, you know, run away, run away. And his wife gets up and she gives this fantastic speech. She says, "Every man born to see the light of day must die. If you wish safety, my lord, that's an easy matter. But consider if when you reach safety, you may not desire to exchange that safety for death. As for me, I've always thought purple makes the best shroud. I thought, what a wonderful speech. You know, after that, there's no thought of running away.
But she also was saying, just think, one day Lars Brownworth is going to tell the world your story. Do you want it to be that you ran?
That's right.
You're one of the top 50 podcasts. What do you think the attraction is?
On the one hand, the timeliness of it. I think the Middle East has really been thrust to the forefront of our consciousness. And it's a ripping good story that really no one knows anything about.
By the way, Lars Brownworth, a high school American history teacher at Stony Brook School on Long Island, what do the kids think of your podcasts?
They're very supportive. Some of them ask me for autographs. It's been quite a ride.
Lars Brownworth, again, the creator of the podcast 12 Byzantine Rulers. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And you can link at our website. We're ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President's Day is the start of a week of school vacation in many parts of the country. And for those of you with kids, Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr has a suggestion. How about a movie? An old movie. Maybe one in black and white. Are you saying no way? Well, so did Ty, until he showed Bringing Up Baby to guests at his daughter's 9th birthday party. The 1938 comedy stars Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn as a zoologist and a socialite who get saddled with Baby the leopard, who loves to be sung to.
I can't give you anything but love, baby. That's the only thing I can give you, baby.
Well, guess what? The party guests loved it, and that inspired Ty to put together a collection of movies that you might want to show your kids. His new book is called The Best Old Movies for Families, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
This is delightful.
Thank you.
I mean, right on the cover, I'm thinking, yes, West Side Story. Why not? You know, but what do you say to people who say, oh, my kids will not watch an old movie?
I would say you haven't picked the right old movie.
Yeah.
My argument is that you should start watching classic films with kids as young as possible. My daughter saw Singing in the Rain when she was 3. She didn't fully understand what was going on, but she went around singing the songs and loved it. As they get older, they just understand that classic movies are a different form of media in addition to all the other stuff that they're watching and taking in.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feel, and I'm happy again.
Well, as you say, you don't have to read this book. You just use it as research when you need it. And let's briefly go through, because you have what you call a starter kit, a list of films for kids 3 to 6, then 7, 12, and 13 plus. So touch on what you think are some of the high points. I have some of the lists right here. Like, let's start with Toddler.
With any kid, if you think they're going to rebel against black and white, it's always good to find a color film.
Mm-hmm.
Singing in the Rain is kind of perfect.
Then The Adventures of Robin Hood.
Again, color, beautiful Technicolor, the best Robin Hood film made. Kids don't know that it was made 70 years ago.
No, it's
Errol Flynn fighting sword duels with Basil Rathbone. They almost know that sword duel from all the other films they've seen it in.
Did I upset your plans? You've come to Nottingham once too often. When this is over, my friend, there'll be no need for me to come again.
But there's no, you know, animated movies there. You really think that the little ones can do these movies?
Yeah, absolutely. You'd be surprised at how capable young children are with dealing with stories about real situations. Not necessarily grown-up situations, some grown-up situations. In my book, I have this story about watching 12 Angry Men with my daughter, who was then about 8. I'd come home from jury duty. She wanted to know what I was doing all day. I tried to explain it, and her eyes started to cross because it was pretty boring. And then literally I looked on, you know, Turner Classics was showing 12 Angry Men in the next half hour. So we kind of cleared the decks, and we sat down and watched it, and she got it.
Remind us, 12 Angry Men.
12 Angry Men is Henry Fonda in a jury room as a juror, helping to lead, you know, the other 11 jurors to look at the case with reasonable doubt.
This kid's been kicked around all of his life. You know, born in a slum, mother dead since he was 9. He lived for a year and a half in an orphanage when his father was serving a jail term for forgery. It's not a very happy beginning. He's a wild, angry kid. That's all he's ever been. And you know why? Because he's been hit on the head by somebody once a day, every day. He's had a pretty miserable 18 years. I just think we owe him a few words, that's all.
One of the great attractions of classic films is that they're relatively discreet. They deal with grown-up themes, but not with grown-up sex, violence, sexuality, brutality. And this is a result of the censorship code that Hollywood, you know, worked under from the 30s through the 60s. And a lot of critics complained at the time that they sort of dumbed movies down for kids, and they had a very real point, but the irony is that they make those films wonderful for kids today.
Well, some other movies that you suggest might start great discussions about bigger moral questions are All About Eve, High Noon. I want to look at some of the other tweener films. Now, tweener, these are what, just, you know, preteens. They're not little kids, but they're not yet 13.
Right, they're from like 8 or 9 to 12 or 13.
Some like it hot for them.
Oh, absolutely. My daughters were on the floor with that and wanted to see it multiple times. Classic comic situation, guys dressed as women. And the fact that it's, you know, Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis. And you've also got Monroe in it, in her best film. And they know that there's something special and a little sad about her. They just pick it up.
I don't want you to think I'm a drinker. I can stop any time I want to, only I don't want to, especially when I'm blue.
We understand.
All the girls drink. It's just that I'm the one that gets caught. Story of my life. I always get the fuzzy end of the lollipop.
Another tweener film you recommend, The African Queen?
Mm-hmm.
They'll get that romance?
Well, they'll get that romance because it's surprising to them. I write about in the book how this is a movie about two people that most of the media kids see generally marginalizes, the slobby janitor and the prissy librarian.
Humphrey Bogart
and Kate Hepburn. And it puts them in a boat together. And they start out as cartoons, and they get humanized. They fall in love with each other over the course of the movie. And for kids, they go from being cartoons to real people.
Well, miss?
Yes, Mr. Walnut.
How'd you like it?
Like it?
White water, rapid.
I never dreamed.
I don't blame you for being scared, miss, not one little bit. Ain't no person in their right mind ain't scared of white water.
I never dreamed that any mere physical experience could be so stimulating.
Teenagers. Psycho.
Here's my feeling on putting Psycho in there. I figure by the time modern American kids are 13 or 14 or 15, they're already seeing The Messengers. They're already seeing The Hitcher. Why not show them Horror Movie 1.0, the beginning modern horror movie?
Rebel Without a Cause you include as well, and for nothing else they could have a crush on Sal Mineo. I mean, why that film?
Or Natalie Wood or James Dean.
It's so many to choose from.
Because to me it's as timeless as Catcher in the Rye is in literature. If you are an adolescent and you feel like the world is going on around you, not with you, and you feel out of sync, this is a movie that still speaks to you.
You're tearing me apart!
What?
You say one thing, he says another, and everybody changes back again.
That's a fine way to behave.
Well, you know who he takes after.
By the way, you know, another thing is, do you recommend people watch these with their kids?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you don't want to put on Psycho and walk out of the room.
Yeah.
The nice thing about watching a classic film is that you can watch together.
But I wonder, too, were there films that you tested on your kids that they said they didn't like?
Oh, absolutely. Gone with the Wind did not play to my daughters. All they could see was these African-American characters that were being silly. They kept asking about Butterfly McQueen. Why is she so silly? And I had to answer, well, that's how Hollywood movies treated black characters back then.
Right. Well, maybe for nothing else, that was a good lesson.
It was an eye-opener, and we had a really good discussion about it. Every movie is a different experience with your kids, but every old movie is a chance to discuss something about the culture in which they live, history, past, in a way that isn't forced, in a way that just comes up. When you watch Casablanca, you have to sort of sketch out some of the basics of World War II, whether you like it or not. And once they get that under their belt, they're off and running into the film. But they also come out with a little understanding of the world and the past.
That's Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. His new book is The Best Old Movies for Families, A Guide to Watching Together. And Ty, thanks so much.
Sure, my pleasure.
And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Songs, never out of date. hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman need man, and man must have his mate. That no one can deny. It's still the same old story.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.